enough to take for granted. The administration's rhetoric, on the other hand, gave the impression that nothing had changed, and from the administration's perspective, nothing had changed, since it had apparently possessed this intelligence report for months, only making it known to the public in early December. The administration's awkward efforts to cope with this new information tied it up in logical and rhetorical knots. First, administration officials tried to discredit the report, even though it was one of the most comprehensive intelligence reports on the subject, complete with over 1,000 source notes. They then claimed that Iran's 2003 abandonment of its weapons program, a fact they drew from the supposedly faulty report, showed that American pressure must have worked, since Iran backed off from developing nuclear weapons just as the United States was invading Iraq. Our government must therefore keep up the pressure by means of yet another round of sanctions. Russia and China did not buy this analysis, and once again, our isolationists in Washington placed America on a lonely and tenuous platform on the world stage. As with Iraq, Iran has been asked to perform the logically impossible feat of proving a negative. Iran is presumed guilty until proven innocent, because there is no evidence with which to indict. There is still no evidence that Iran, a signatory of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, has ever violated the treaty's terms, terms which state that Iran is allowed to pursue nuclear energy for peaceful civilian energy needs. The United States cannot unilaterally change the terms of that treaty, and it is unfair and unwise diplomatically to impose sanctions for no legitimate reason. Iran, incidentally, may have noticed a pattern. If countries do have a nuclear weapon, they tend to be left alone or possibly even given a subsidy. If they do not gain such a weapon, they find themselves threatened with war. With that kind of foreign policy, what country wouldn't want to pursue a nuclear weapon? But in fact, there is no evidence Iran actually has one, or could have one anytime soon, even if it immediately resumed the weapons program. Still, when individuals want a war, any pretext will do, so the NIE report does not guarantee that our government will keep its hands off Iran. In the late summer, with the administration aware that the evidence for an Iranian nuclear weapons program was on the verge of collapse, President Bush signed an executive order designating Iran's elite 125,000-strong Revolutionary Guard Corps as a terrorist group, thereby establishing a new pretext for an attack on Iran. Fewer Americans are likely to accept that as a rationale for war than an Iranian nuclear weapon. The national intelligence estimate, if not ruling out the possibility of war, will at least make it more difficult to sell. Neoconservatives, the false conservatives who got us into the Iraq mess and pushed hard for war with Iran, continue to hold their positions of prominence. Why that is so is quite beyond me. Every last prediction they made about the Iraq debacle, e.g., it would be a cakewalk, the cost would be paid by oil revenues, the prospect of sectarian fighting was slim, has been resolutely falsified by events. And yet they continue to grace the pages of major American newspapers and appear regularly on cable television talk shows. Instead of being disgraced, as common sense might lead us to expect, they continue to be exalted for a wisdom they obviously do not possess. I am reminded of George Orwell's reference to the streamlined men who think in slogans and talk in bullets. Meanwhile, where is the exposure for those who favor a non-interventionist foreign policy? These individuals would have avoided the Iraq fiasco altogether. America would be trillions richer over the long term. Iraqi society would not be in shambles, and countless Americans and Iraqis alike would still be alive. Non-interventionists have been entirely vindicated, and yet they do not enjoy the places of prominence that the establishment has bestowed on those who have been consistently wrong and responsible for carnage and destruction that have destroyed our good name around the world and isolated us more than ever in our history. In fact, they are scarcely to be found at all. Although you'd never know it by reading the print media or watching television talk shows, we who support the foreign policy of the Founding Fathers hold an honored place in the history of the Republican Party and of the conservative and libertarian movements. The so-called Old Right, or Original Right, opposed big government at home and abroad, and considered foreign interventionism to be the other side of the same statist coin as interventionism at home. They recognized that big government was no more honest or competent in foreign policy than it was in domestic policy. In both cases, it was the same institution with the same people operating under the same incentives. Felix Morley was one of the founders of Human Events, the oldest conservative weekly in America. In 1957, he wrote an essay called American Republic or American Empire for Modern Age, the conservative journal founded by Russell Kirk. There, Morley warned, "We are trying to make a federal republic do an imperial job without honestly confronting the fact that our traditional institutions are specifically designed to prevent centralization of power. At some time and at some point, however, this fundamental conflict between our institutions and our policies will have to be resolved." In Freedom and Federalism, Morley quoted Adolf Hitler as saying that a powerful national government may encroach considerably upon the liberty of individuals as well as of the different states, and assume the responsibility for it, without weakening the empire idea, if only every citizen recognizes such measures as means for making his nation greater. Morley then elaborated on what Hitler meant. In other words, the problem of empire building is essentially mystical. It must somehow foster the impression that a man is great in the degree that his nation is great, that a German as such is superior to a Belgian as such, an Englishman to an Irishman, an American to a Mexican, merely because the first-named countries are in each case more powerful than their comparatives, and people who have no individual stature whatsoever are willing to accept this poisonous nonsense because it gives them a sense of importance without the trouble of any personal effort. The phenomenon Morley describes could not be further removed from the ideas of republican government, which have grown foreign to us after decades of military overstretch. Russell Kirk was one of the chief founders of American conservatism, and his book, The Conservative Mind, has been one of its most influential texts. And he, too, was suspicious of militarism. He was a critic of high military spending and opposed the Vietnam War, albeit privately. By the 1990s, he was an outspoken opponent of his government's military interventions and was concerned that they were making his country unnecessary enemies. Presidents Woodrow Wilson, Franklin Roosevelt, and Lyndon Johnson were enthusiasts for American domination of the world, Kirk said in 1991 at the Heritage Foundation. Now George H.W. Bush appears to be emulating those eminent Democrats. In general, Republicans throughout the 20th century have been advocates of prudence and restraint in the conduct of foreign affairs. As for wars for democracy, Kirk, being the traditional conservative he was, could hardly take the idea seriously. "Are we to saturation bomb most of Africa and Asia into righteousness, freedom, and democracy?" Kirk wondered. "And having accomplished that, however would we ensure persons yet more unrighteous might not rise up instead of the ogres we had swept away?" Just that is what happened in the Congo, remember, 3 decades ago? And nowadays in Zaire, once called the Belgian Congo, we zealously uphold with American funds the dictator Mobutu, more bloodstained than Saddam. And have we forgotten Castro in Cuba? In his book, The Political Principles of Robert A. Taft, which he wrote with James McClellan, Kirk noted his subject's aversion to war. Taft was the great exemplar of the old right in the Senate in the 1940s and 1950s. War, Taft perceived, was the enemy of Constitution, liberty, economic security, and the cake of custom. Though he was no theoretical pacifist, he insisted that every other possibility must be exhausted before resort to military action. War would make the American president a virtual dictator, diminish the constitutional powers of Congress, contract civil liberties, injure the habitual self-reliance and self-government of the American people, distort the economy, sink the federal government in debt, break in upon private and public morality. He went on, Taft's prejudice in favor of peace was equaled in strength by his prejudice against empire. Quite as the Romans had acquired an empire in a fit of absence of mind, he feared that America might make herself an imperial power with the best of intentions and the worst of results. He foresaw the grim possibility of American garrisons in distant corners of the world, a vast permanent military establishment, an intolerant democratism imposed in the name of the American way of life, neglect of America's domestic concerns in the pursuit of transoceanic powers, squandering of American resources upon amorphous international designs, the decay of liberty at home in proportion as America presumed to govern the world, that is, the garrison state, a term he employed more than once. The record of the United States as administrator of territories overseas has not been heartening, and the American Constitution made no provision for a widespread and enduring imperial government. Aspiring to redeem the world from all the ills to which flesh is heir, Americans might descend, instead, into a leaden imperial domination and corruption. Richard Weaver, still another central figure in the history of conservatism, and perhaps best known for his book, Ideas Have Consequences, opposed the atomic bombing of Japan and spoke with contempt of Theodore Roosevelt, who would strut and bluster and intimidate our weaker neighbors. Weaver wrote an extraordinary essay on the immorality of total war in his book, Visions of Order, arguing that of the many things which cause us to feel that spirit indispensable to civilization has been weakened, none should arouse deeper alarm than total war. The conservative sociologist Robert Nesbitt reminded his audience that war was revolutionary, not conservative. He likewise warned that socialist proposals have often, under wartime conditions, become the law of the land. These last three figures, Kirk, Weaver, and Nesbitt, share something in common. One of the most useful and respected studies of American conservatism, George Nash's book, The Conservative Intellectual Movement in America Since 1945, identifies these three men as the most important thinkers among what he calls traditionalist conservatives. That means the three most significant traditional conservative intellectuals in the post-war period were all wary of militarism to one degree or another. None were pacifists, naturally, but they all believed that war was something so materially and morally catastrophic that it genuinely had to be considered only a last resort. And since, as Randolph Bourne said, war is the health of the state, they also understood the undesirable domestic side effects of war, such as taxes, debt, lost liberties, centralization, and the emasculation of the Constitution. How does Israel, with which the United States has long enjoyed a special relationship, fit into this picture? I see no reason that our friendship with Israel cannot continue. I favor extending to Israel the same honest friendship that Jefferson and the Founding Fathers urged us to offer to all nations. But that also means no special privileges like foreign aid, a position I maintain vis-a-vis all other countries as well. That means I also favor discontinuing foreign aid to governments that are actual or potential enemies of Israel, which taken together receive considerably more American aid than Israel does. Giving aid to both sides has understandably made many average Israelis and American Jews conclude that the American government is hypocritically hedging its bets. I oppose all foreign aid on principle, for reasons I detail in a later chapter. Foreign aid is not only immoral, since it involves the forced transfer of wealth, but it is also counterproductive, as a ceaseless stream of scholarship continues to show. Foreign aid has been a disaster in Africa, delaying sound economic reforms and encouraging wastefulness and statism. We should not wish it on our worst enemy, much less a friend. Moreover, since the aid has to be spent on products made by American corporations, it is really just a form of corporate welfare, which I can never support. Only those with a very superficial attachment to Israel can really be happy that she continues to rely on over $2 billion in American aid every year. In the absence of such grants, Israel would at last be under pressure to adopt a freer economy, thereby bringing about greater prosperity for her people and making it easier for her to be self-reliant. Foreign aid only inhibits salutary reforms like this, reforms that any true friend of Israel is eager to see. As a matter of fact, the Institute for Advanced Strategic and Political Studies in Jerusalem argues that foreign aid is the greatest obstacle to economic freedom in Israel. It is an open secret that Israel's military industry is inefficient and top-heavy with bureaucracy, shortcomings that consistent American aid obviously encourages. Why make difficult adjustments when billions in aid can be counted on regardless of what you do? Our government has also done Israel a disservice by effectually infringing on her sovereignty. Israel seeks American approval for military actions she deems necessary. She consults with America on matters pertaining to her own borders, and she even seeks American approval for peace talks with her neighbors, approval that is not always forthcoming. This needs to stop. And with an arsenal of hundreds of nuclear weapons, Israel is more than capable of deterring or repelling any enemy. She should once again be in charge of her own destiny. In the face of human cost of war, the thousands of American servicemen killed, the tens of thousands wounded, the civilian deaths, a reckoning of its material costs may seem almost obtuse, but we are not speaking of a few billion dollars here and there. The cost of our foreign policy have become so great that they risk bringing the country to bankruptcy. When I say bankruptcy, I do not mean that the federal government will stop writing checks and spending money. The federal government is not likely to go out of business anytime soon. I mean that the checks and the money won't buy anything because the dollar will have been destroyed. Few Americans realize just how costly our foreign policy is. Larry Lindsey, senior economic advisor to the Bush administration, embarrassed the White House when he warned in the Wall Street Journal that the Iraq War could cost $100 to $200 billion. Outrageous, officials said. The course of events had made Lindsey's estimate into the epitome of optimism. In early 2006, Harvard's Linda Bilmes and Columbia's Joseph Stiglitz estimated the long-term costs of the war, including care for our maimed soldiers, at $2 trillion. By the end of the year, they were saying that the $2 trillion figure was too low. It isn't just the Iraq war that busts the budget. It's our overseas military presence as a whole. We have reached the point at which it now costs $1 trillion per year to maintain. $1 trillion. The proposed Pentagon budget alone was $623 billion for 2008. What's remarkable about this year's military budget, wrote one military analyst, is that it's the largest budget since World War II, but of course, we're not fighting World War II. And just as in domestic spending, where higher budgets rarely translate into better performance, I am doubtful that much of this expenditure is actually contributing to our security. America would be much stronger and more secure if our government observed a non-interventionist foreign policy and put an end to its international overstretch. And that isn't just because foreign meddling makes us more enemies, though that commonsensical point is certainly correct. Beyond even that, we waste a staggering amount of manpower, hardware, and wealth on a bloated overseas presence that would be better devoted to protecting the United States itself. Our forces are stretched much too thin, what with our 700 bases around the world and all the nation-building work that conservatives not so long ago criticized Bill Clinton for imposing on our military. We have had troops in Korea for over 5.5 decades. We have had troops in Europe and Japan for about as long. How many years is enough? An American presence in these places was supposed to be temporary, persisting only during the military emergencies that were cited as justification for bringing them there. Milton Friedman was right. There is nothing so permanent as a temporary government program. With a $9 trillion debt, perhaps $50 trillion in entitlement liabilities, and the dollar in free fall, how much longer can we afford this unnecessary and counterproductive extravagance? While our government engages in deficit spending to fund its military exploits overseas, detracting from our own productivity, countries like China are filling the void by expanding their trade opportunities. I have never understood this talk of our military presence as a strategic reserve of Western civilization. Instead, the best indication of our civilization has been our prestige in international trade. We should let the best measure of our American greatness come from free and peaceful trade with other nations, not from displays of our military might. Now, it would be a great step forward if we could even debate the foreign policy we have now, a policy that, with a few minor differences, is shared by the establishment of both major parties. One writer correctly labels it, "the debate we never have." Although many Americans oppose the continued expansion of big government abroad, non-intervention is never presented to them as an option. The so-called debates between pundits they see on television or read in the newspaper carefully limit the range of debate to the point of insignificance. The debate is always framed in terms of which kind of interventionist strategy our government should pursue. The possibility that we should avoid bleeding ourselves dry in endless foreign meddling is not raised. For heaven's sake, what kind of debate is it in which all sides agree that America needs troops in 130 countries? That may have been the kind of debate that the old Pravda once allowed, but where is the robust exchange of ideas that we should expect in a free society? If we ever have such a debate, some Americans may conclude that the increased risk of terrorism is a price they are willing to pay in order to continue our government's interventionist foreign policy. Others will realize that foreign interventionism is bankrupting us and making us less secure. However it came out, at least we would have had the debate. At the end of such a debate, Michael Schauer concludes, Americans may decide that the foreign policy status quo that exists at the moment is what they want. But if they do, they will at least go into it with their eyes open and know that they are in for an extended period of war, a tremendously bloody and costly war. Meanwhile, our lack of debate has had terrible consequences for our republic. James Bamford observes that the leadership of Al-Qaeda hoped to lure us into a desert Vietnam, an enormously expensive war that would deplete our resources and help their own recruitment by stirring up the locals against us. And that is just what happened. The war's ultimate cost is being estimated in the trillions. The dollar is collapsing, and more terrorists are being created. According to a study by the Global Research and International Affairs Center in Herzliya, Israel, the vast bulk of the foreign fighters in Iraq are people who have never been involved in terrorist activity before, but have been radicalized by the U.S. presence in Iraq, the second holiest place in Islam. The terrorists, in short, have played us like a fiddle. With the unnecessary and unprovoked attack on Iraq, our government gave them just what they wanted. Americans have the right to defend themselves against attack. That is not at issue. But that is very different from launching a preemptive war against the country that had not attacked us and could not attack us, that lacked the Navy and an Air Force, and whose military budget was a fraction of a percent of our own. A policy of overthrowing or destabilizing every regime our government dislikes is no strategy at all, unless our goal is international chaos and domestic impoverishment. It is time for us to consider a strategic reassessment of our policy of foreign interventionism, occupation, and nation-building. It is in our national interest to do so, and in the interest of world peace. This is a message that resonates not only with the American people at large, but also with U.S. military personnel. In the second quarter of 2007, our campaign raised more money from active duty and retired military than did any other Republican candidate. And in the third quarter, we raised more than any candidate in either party. This message is popular, and it is based on American security, fiscal sanity, and common sense. Chapter 3. The Constitution. The written constitutions may be violated in moments of passion or delusion, wrote Thomas Jefferson in 1802, yet they furnish a text to which those who are watchful may again rally and recall the people. Whether we are yet emerging from our own moment of disorientation after 9/11 is difficult to say. I believe, though, that enough Americans are taking a sober second look at what we have allowed our country to become, especially since that terrible day, that the Constitution may yet reemerge as a document to which the people may be rallied and recalled. In early American history, the Constitution figured heavily in political debate. People wanted to know, and politicians needed to justify, where the various schemes they debated in Congress were authorized in the Constitution. In the 21st century, by contrast, the Constitution is like the elephant at the Tea Party that everyone pretends not to notice. The power of the executive branch, for instance, has expanded far beyond what the framers of the Constitution envisioned. One mechanism that has strengthened it is the executive order, an instrument by which presidents have exerted powers that our Constitution never intended them to have. An executive order is a command issued by the president that enjoys his authority alone, not having been passed by Congress. Executive orders can have legitimate functions. Presidents can carry out their constitutional duties or direct their subordinates by executive order, for instance. But they can also be a source of temptation for ambitious presidents. Am I being redundant? Since they can always try to get away with using them as a substitute for formal legislation that they know they cannot get to pass. He can thereby circumvent the normal constitutional legislative process. Executive orders were rare in the 19th century. For a president to issue even several dozen was unusual. The first 20th century president to serve a full term, Theodore Roosevelt, who served two in fact, issued over 1,000. His distant cousin, Franklin Roosevelt, issued over 3,000. Executive orders continue to serve as a potent weapon in the president's arsenal. Congress has sometimes been complicit in presidential abuses of executive orders, either by giving express sanction to the president's action after the fact or ignoring the abuse of power altogether. This latter course is sometimes pursued when congressmen happen to favor the president's course of action, but do not want to have to associate themselves with it, perhaps because it is controversial or politically sensitive. With executive orders, presidents can commit our troops to undeclared wars, destroy industries, or make unprecedented social policy changes. And they remain unaccountable because often these actions occur behind the door of the Oval Office, are distributed without notice, and then executed in stealth. This is a travesty against our constitutional system, and any president worthy of the office would absolutely forswear the use of executive orders, except when he can show express constitutional or statutory authority for his action. Yet another abuse, though, and all the more troubling for being unknown to most Americans, involves the use of something called presidential signing statements. When the president signs a bill into law, he sometimes accompanies the signing with a statement, not necessarily read aloud at the signing ceremony, but inserted into the record all the same. This practice was not unheard of in previous administrations, though it was nearly always employed for ceremonial purposes, to thank supporters, to point out the significance of the legislation, and in pursuit of rhetorical ends of a similar kind. The Bush administration, on the other hand, has very often used the signing statement as a vehicle either for expressing the manner in which the president intends to interpret certain provisions of a law, his interpretation being frequently at odds with the one Congress obviously intended, or for even making clear his intention of not enforcing the provision in question at all. It is not always easy to determine whether the president has followed through on these threats, since they are so often made in areas that the White House shrouds in secrecy. Foreign policy and privacy violations. In 2005, though, the Government Accountability Office gave us a very rough estimate of how many of these threatened refusals to enforce legislative provisions were followed up on. In about one-third of the 19 cases it examined, the provision was not being enforced. Law professor Jonathan Turley was blunt. By using signing statements to this extent, the president becomes a government unto himself. The Bush administration has challenged more legislative provisions in this way than any other presidential administration in American history. If Bill Clinton had done this, we would still be hearing about it. Today, few Republicans in public life have been courageous or principled enough to speak out against a clear abuse of power. Among them are Bruce Fein, Associate Deputy Attorney General under Ronald Reagan, and former Congressman Bob Barr. Again, an American president must pledge never to use the signing statement as an alternative, unconstitutional form of legislative power, and Congress and the American people should hold them to it. Much of the recent revival of interest in the Constitution centers around the Bill of Rights and the War on Terror, a subject I discuss elsewhere in this book. I could not be more sympathetic to these concerns. However, Americans must remember that the Constitution was designed not merely to prevent the federal government from violating the rights that later appeared in the Bill of Rights. It was also intended to limit the federal government's overall scope. Article 1, Section 8 lists the powers of Congress. Common law held such lists of powers to be exhaustive. According to the 10th Amendment to the Constitution, all powers not delegated to the federal government by the states, in Article 1, Section 8, and not prohibited to the states in the Constitution, in Article 1, Section 10, are reserved to the states or to the people. Thomas Jefferson held that this principle formed the very foundation of our Constitution. It was a guarantee that the experience Americans endured under the British would not be repeated, and that political decisions would be made by their own local legislatures rather than by a distant central government that would be much more difficult, if not impossible, for them to control. Jefferson's approach to the Constitution, which he adamantly believed could be understood by the average person, and was not some secret teaching that had to be divined by immortals in black robes, was refreshingly simple. If a proposed federal law was not listed among the powers granted to Congress in Article 1, Section 8, then no matter how otherwise attractive it seemed, it had to be rejected on constitutional grounds. If it were especially wise or desirable, there would be no difficulty in amending the Constitution to allow for it. And according to Jefferson, we should always bear in mind, to the extent possible, the original intention of those who drafted and ratified the Constitution. On every question of construction, carry ourselves back to the time when the Constitution was adopted. Recollect the spirit manifested in the debates, and instead of trying what meaning may be squeezed out of the text or invented against it, conform to the probable one in which it was passed. Our peculiar security is in possession of a written Constitution, Jefferson advised us. Let us not make it a blank paper by construction. Jefferson was afraid, in other words, that we would allow our government to interpret the Constitution so broadly that we may as well be governed by a blank piece of paper. The limitations the Constitution placed on the federal government had to be taken seriously if we expected to maintain a free society. There would always be a powerful temptation to allow the federal government to do something many people wanted, but that the Constitution did not authorize. Since the amendment process is time-consuming, there would be a further temptation. Just exercise the unauthorized power without amending the Constitution. But then, what is the point of having a Constitution at all? It is true that, although Jefferson was a great constitutional exegete, he was not himself present at the Constitutional Convention. But Jefferson's ideas were not his alone. They reflected many of the sentiments expressed at his state's ratifying convention by such important and diverse figures as Edmund Randolph, George Nicholas, and Patrick Henry, not to mention John Taylor of Caroline, perhaps the most prolific political pamphleteer of the 1790s. Jefferson was merely giving voice to this much larger tradition when he expounded his strict constructionist views. "Confidence is everywhere the parent of despotism," said Jefferson in 1798. "Free government is founded in jealousy and not in confidence. In matters of power, let no more be heard of confidence in man, but bind him down from mischief by the chains of the Constitution." Nearly a quarter of a century later, Jefferson could still be heard uttering the same warning. Is confidence or discretion, or is strict limit the principle of our Constitution? I sometimes hear the objection that certain phrases in the Constitution give the federal government more power than what is listed in Article 1, Section 8. The General Welfare Clause is often cited, although equally dishonest interpretations of the Interstate Commerce and Necessary and Proper Clauses have also been put forward. I have already noted that common law held lists of powers such as the one in Article 1, Section 8, to be exhaustive, a point that refutes the idea that qualifying phrases like general welfare could give an open-ended character to the powers themselves. But the testimony of the framers is also very clear. James Madison wrote, "If Congress can do whatever in their discretion can be done by money and will promote the general welfare, the government is no longer a limited one, possessing enumerated powers, but an indefinite one, subject to particular exceptions." Toward the end of his life, he added, "With respect to the words general welfare, I have always regarded them as qualified by the detail of powers connected with them. To take them with a literal and unlimited sense would be a metamorphosis of the Constitution into a character which there is a host of proofs was not contemplated by its creators." And, of course, as Madison elsewhere wrote, if the federal government really had been intended to carry out whatever action might promote the general welfare, what was the point of listing its specific powers in Article 1, Section 8, since the superpower would have covered all of those anyway? The typical reply to this argument, if one is forthcoming at all, is that Alexander Hamilton had a different view of the General Welfare Clause. Indeed, he did. But what does that prove? Hamilton was dramatically out of step with most of the other delegates to the Constitutional Convention. He was also inconsistent in his views, saying one thing before the Constitution was ratified and another after ratification. In his 1791 report on manufacturers, he denied that the spending authority of Congress was confined to the powers enumerated in Article 1, Section 8, laying out a broad array of areas he wanted to see receive government funding, precisely the areas he denied the national government would have jurisdiction over when he wrote Federalist No. 17 and Federalist No. 34 several years earlier. Patrick Henry raised precisely this concern as the ratification of the Constitution was being debated in Virginia. Wasn't general welfare a dangerously open-ended phrase that would permit the federal government to do whatever it wanted, since government officials could blandly claim that all its measures were intended to promote the general welfare? Supporters of the Constitution gave Henry a definitive answer. No. General welfare did not and could not have such a broad meaning. Now, isn't our Constitution a living document that evolves in accordance with experience and changing times, as we're so often told? No, 1,000 times No. If we feel the need to change our Constitution, we are free to amend it. In 1817, James Madison reminded Congress that the framers had marked out in the Constitution itself a safe and practicable mode of improving it as experience might suggest, a reference to the amendment process. But that is not what advocates of a so-called living Constitution have in mind. They favor a system in which the federal government, and in particular the federal courts, are at liberty, even in the absence of any amendment, to interpret the Constitution altogether differently from how it was understood by those who drafted it and those who voted to ratify it. Leave aside the alleged problem of determining exactly what the framers intended by this or that constitutional clause. Supporters of the living Constitution must be able to figure out the original intent well enough if they are so sure we need to evolve away from it. If the people agreed to a particular understanding of the Constitution, and over the course of the intervening years they have performed no official act, such as amending the Constitution in accordance with their evolved ideas, reversing that original understanding, by what right may government unilaterally change the terms of its contract with the people, interpreting its words to mean something very different from what the American people had all along been told they meant? A living Constitution is just the thing any government would be delighted to have, for whenever the people complain that their Constitution has been violated, the government can trot out its judges to inform the people that they've simply misunderstood. The Constitution, you see, has merely evolved with the times. Thus, as in Orwell's Animal Farm, no animal shall sleep in a bed because no animal shall sleep in a bed with sheets. No animal shall drink alcohol becomes no animal shall drink alcohol to excess. And no animal shall kill any other animal becomes no animal shall kill any other animal without cause. That's why on this issue, I agree with historian Kevin Gutzman, who says that those who would give us a living constitution are actually giving us a dead constitution, since such a thing is completely unable to protect us against the encroachments of government power. During my public life, I have earned the nickname Dr. No, a reference to my previous occupation as a physician, combined with my willingness to stand against the entire Congress, if necessary, to vote no on some proposed measure. I am told I have been the sole no vote in Congress more often than all other members of Congress put together. As a matter of fact, I don't especially care for this nickname, since it may give people the impression that I am a contrarian for its own sake, and that for some reason I simply relish saying no. In those no votes, as in all my congressional votes, I have thought of myself as saying yes to the Constitution and to freedom. The Constitution has much to say to us regarding foreign policy, if we will only listen. For over half a century, the two major parties have done their best to ignore what it has to say, especially when it comes to the initiation of hostilities. Both parties have allowed the president to exercise powers of which the framers of the Constitution thought they had deprived him. And since both parties have been contemptuous of the Constitution's allocation of war powers between the president and Congress, neither one, with very rare exceptions, ever calls the other out on it. The framers did not want the American president to resemble the British king, from whom they had separated just a few years earlier. Even Alexander Hamilton, who was known to be sympathetic toward the British model, was at pains in the Federalist Papers to point out a critical difference between the king and the president as envisioned by the Constitution. The president is to be commander-in-chief of the Army and Navy of the United States. In this respect, his authority would be nominally the same with that of the King of Great Britain, but in substance, much inferior to it. It would amount to nothing more than the supreme command and direction of the military and naval forces as first general and admiral of the Confederacy, while that of the British King extends to the declaring of war and to the raising and regulating of fleets and armies, all of which by the Constitution under consideration would appertain to the legislature. Whatever kind of evidence you want to examine, whether constitutional or historical, The verdict is clear. Congress was supposed to declare war, and the president in turn was to direct the war once it was declared. This rule was scrupulously observed throughout American history until 1950 and the Korean War. Short of a full-fledged declaration of war, in lesser conflicts, Congress nevertheless authorized hostilities by statute. Any exceptions to this general rule involved military activity so minor and on such a small scale as hardly to be worth mentioning. The Korean War was the great watershed in the modern presidential power grab in war-making. President Harry Truman sent Americans halfway around the world without so much as a nod in the direction of Congress. According to Truman, authorization from the United Nations to use force was quite sufficient and rendered congressional consent unnecessary. Apart from being dangerous, that idea is simply false. Article 43 of the United Nations Charter states that any United Nations authorization to use force must be subsequently referred to the governments of each nation in accordance with their respective constitutional processes. This principle was reaffirmed in the United States in the debates over the United Nations Participation Act of 1945. Truman also claimed that the Constitution's Commander-in-Chief Clause gave him the authority to plunge America into war on his own initiative. Truman's interpretation of the Constitution was completely untenable. Nothing in American history supports it. Not the Constitutional Convention, the state ratifying conventions, the Federalist Papers, early court decisions, or the actual practice of war-making throughout most of American history. Even the early examples that are typically cited as evidence of presidential war-making, John Adams's actions during the Quasi-War with France, and Thomas Jefferson's confrontation with the Barbary pirates of North Africa, show no such thing. Both of these minor incidents were carried out according to congressional statute, with the Supreme Court ruling that a presidential directive contrary to such statutes was of no force. In spite of its complete lack of constitutional foundation, this belief that the president may take the country to war on his own authority without consulting anyone has become the conventional wisdom in both major parties, although there has been a modest backlash against it since the Iraq War. Neoconservatives have been particularly eager to promote this deviation from the Constitution. This, it seems, is their version of the living Constitution. Interestingly enough, one of the chief critics of Truman's exercise of power was Senator Robert A. Taft, one of the most conservative Republicans of his day, and who was in fact known as Mr. Republican. Speaking on the Senate floor, Taft denounced Truman's arguments and behavior in no uncertain terms. "I desire this afternoon to discuss only the question of the power claimed by the president to send troops anywhere in the world and involve us in any war in the world and involve us in any war in which he chooses to involve us. I wish to assert the powers of Congress and to point out that Congress has the power to prevent any such action by the president, that he has no such power under the Constitution, and that it is incumbent upon the Congress to assert clearly its own constitutional powers unless it desires to lose them." In the long run, Taft went on, "the question we must decide involves vitally, I think, not only the freedom of the people of the United States, but the peace of the people of the United States. If in the great field of foreign policy, the president has arbitrary and unlimited power, as he now claims, then there is an end to freedom in the United States in a great realm of domestic activity, which affects, in the long run, every person in the United States. If the president has unlimited power to involve us in war, war is more likely. History shows that arbitrary rulers are more inclined to favor war than are the people at any time." Responding to various defenses offered by the president and administration officials, Taft declared, "I deny the conclusion of the documents presented by the president or by the executive department, and I would say that if the doctrines therein proclaimed prevailed, they would bring an end to government by the people, because our foreign interests are going gradually to predominate and require a larger and larger place in the field of the activities of our people. In 2002, as war with Iraq loomed, I proposed that Congress officially declare war against Iraq, making clear that I intended to oppose my own measure. The point was to underscore our constitutional responsibility to declare war before commencing major military operations, rather than leaving the decision to the President or passing resolutions that delegate to the President the decision-making power over war. The chairman of the International Relations Committee responded by saying, "There are things in the Constitution that have been overtaken by events, by time. Declaration of war is one of them. There are things no longer relevant to a modern society. We are saying to the President, use your judgment. What you have proposed is inappropriate, anachronistic. It isn't done anymore." What a relief that we have people in our government who will keep us posted on which constitutional provisions they have decided are no longer relevant. Now, didn't Congress authorize the war in Iraq after all? No, and certainly not in a manner consistent with the Constitution. Congress has no constitutional authority to delegate to the President the decision regarding whether to use military force. That power was consciously and for good reason put in the hands of the people's elected representatives in the legislature. Louis Fisher, one of the nation's experts on the subject of presidential war powers, described what happened this way. The resolution helped bring pressure on the Security Council to send inspectors into Iraq to search for weapons of mass destruction. They found nothing. As to whether war should or should not occur, the committee washed its hands. By passing legislation that allowed the President to make that decision, Congress transferred a primary constitutional duty from the legislative branch to the executive branch. That is precisely what the framers fought against. Meanwhile, all these wars have to be fought by someone, and that is why the military draft is being spoken about more and more. Given the overseas ambitions of so much of our political class, a return of the draft may actually be closer than we realize. As a matter of fact, we have something like a de facto draft already, what with all the extensions being imposed on our troops. Having stretched our military to the breaking point, where do they expect to find the troops for the next conflict? The draft is a totalitarian institution that is based on the idea that the government owns you and can dispose of your life as it wishes. Republican Senator Robert Taft said that the draft was far more typical of totalitarian nations than of democratic nations. It is absolutely opposed to the principles of individual liberty, which have always been considered a part of American democracy. Conservative thinker Russell Kirk referred to the draft as slavery.